This podcast is brought to you by Minimal Productions, producer Jim Minns.
This is Diplomates, a geopolitical chinwag with your host, Misha Zelinsky.
G'day, Diplomates fans. I'm Misha. This week, I had my good friend Hagar Shamali back on the show to unpack everything happening in the world of geopolitics. And boy, oh boy, is there a lot going on. Now, obviously, we talk about the fate of Yevgeny Prigozhin, dead or alive. We talk about what's happening in Ukraine. We also take a really good look at Africa. Now, I don't want to call this a deep dive, but there is a lot of political unrest right across Northern Africa and a lot of different countries there. We talk about what it means for the situation in those countries, but we also take a broader look at what this unrest across Africa tells us about the geopolitical struggle between autocratic regimes and democracies that's playing out at a more macro level across the world. We talk about this Made in China map, which has caused such a huge diplomatic, well, I'll call it an incident, but blowback right across the world, but particularly around the Indo-Pacific and East Asia. We talk about the BRICS meeting and the new expansion, new membership of the BRICS grouping. We talk about Xi Jinping, domestic pressure he might be under, why he's suddenly not attending conferences and what that means. Let's talk about Vladimir Putin's meeting with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un, the Rocket Man, and his visit to Moscow and what we think that means, not just for the war, but what it tells us about the fate of Vladimir Putin's Russia. Plenty to talk about. If you're new to the show, we've had a lot of new listeners lately, so thank you for listening. If you are new to the show, if you're even a long-time listener, but you haven't yet done so, please subscribe to the show. It actually makes a big difference, the number of subscribers we have. It helps, basically helps us spread the word, because the more subscribers, the more Apple and other podcast services rate the show. And if you haven't already done so, and you're probably sitting here hearing me say this, but please rate and review the show. It really, really does make a huge difference to spread the word. A little bit of personal news from me, and I know this is a slightly longer introduction than I normally like to give, but those of you who've been asking me, yes, I do have a book coming out. If you haven't been asking me, well, here's some news. So I have a book coming out in November of this year. It's called The Sun Will Rise. It is a narrative account of the war inside Ukraine, so Russia's invasion of Ukraine. It is a narrative fiction based on true events. It's been distributed by Simon & Schuster in the United States. You can buy it now. I have more to say about it. It's not out until late November, but you can start pre-ordering it. It'll be in the show notes. Do please order a copy. Please keep an eye out for it, because I'm pretty excited about it. But other than that, enough gibbering from me. Enjoy the episode. Hagar, welcome to Diplomates. Good to see you again, mate. How are you?
So good to be back. Great to see you, Misha. I have been on vacation for a while, and I'm so happy to jump right back in.
What better way than to have the whiplash of post-vacation blues than to come back and do a podcast about foreign policy with me, right? That's, what else would you... I know you've been dreaming about it whilst you've been on a beach.
You know, I said that for a while, because things always heat up in August when you leave, but there, it seemed like for a while there was nothing going on, but I really believe that was because I actually deliberately tuned out. But there was a lot that happened. We have a lot to catch up on.
We do. Now, I'm going to start with true or false. Yevgeny Prigozhin, dead?
True. And true, he's dead.
Can you believe there are people that are actually trying to put forward conspiracy theories that he's still alive? But anyway,
I can't believe that, because he's such a... he loves selfies. He loves the attention. This is not a guy that if he were alive, that he would find a way to tell people that he were alive. No, I think he's dead. And I also believe, by the way, that he was on that plane and died in that plane. I don't think it was a cover and that he had died earlier or anything like that.
Also, his disguises that he was, they leaked those photos of him with the Sacha Baron Cohen style beards or whatever. They just weren't good enough really for him to pass as anyone other than Yevgeny Prigozhin. That head of his,
yes,
you could pick that out of a crowd of a billion. So,
oh, completely. Look,
I'm glad you agree. In terms of what's happening inside Ukraine right now, Ukraine's actually making a fair bit of advance on the battlefield, which is good. It's interesting, actually. So, yeah, the pocket theory, and anyone who reads my writing will know this, and I've been saying it, that I still think that the Ukrainians can split the Russians in two. somewhere along the Azov Sea, when you look at the very long strip of land that Russia controls towards Crimea and the southern part of Ukraine. But the Ukrainians have now penetrated through the first line of defence. They've gotten through a lot of the mines there to a town called Robotne. And now there's a place called Tokmak, which is in sight, and then obviously Melitopol, which is much closer, not on the sea, but much closer to the sea, and that would basically sever the land bridge. What's interesting, though, is that if the Ukrainians can capture another 10 or 15 kilometres, so another 7 to 10 miles, basically it would have the same effect. So all of a sudden they go, okay, you got to get to the ocean to sever the land bridge, to sever the Russian ability to resupply themselves, and essentially half their army be on the other side of that division. But if the Ukrainians can advance another, as I said, 10 to 15 kilometres, that has the same impact, because what it will do is sever the Russian, what they call GLOCs, the ground lines of communication. So essentially the Russians, all their logistical supply chains would be in range of Ukrainian weapons. And so the Ukrainians at that point would basically be able to deny the Russians the ability to resupply themselves. So that's what I've been theorizing. It seems to be more and more, if not likely, increasingly probable. And I think when you look at the reports from military bloggers on the Russian side, a lot of panic on their side, a lot of criticism of Russian leadership, which is always a good sign if you're a friend of Ukraine, that they think things are going badly. And also reports of the Russian troops not being rotated out of those frontline trenches. They've been there for long, long stretches at a time, weeks, some of them months. Give you a sense of that, in World War One, the policy of the British on their front lines in the trenches was 1 week on the front line, 1 week on the second line, and a week off rest. And the Russians are absolutely not getting any level of rotation. So I think all those things add up. And if the Ukrainians do break through, I think the Russians will have a good chance of collapsing, which then brings me to my number one grand theory, which is that would lead to Putin's removal. And anyone can, if you aren't asking, well, how would that happen? Go read my columns. I'm not going to repeat them now. Anyway, so that is the update on the Ukraine war. The reason why I raised Prigozhin is not actually about Ukraine, but I wanted to pick your brain about what all this means for a place where Wagner and Prigozhin were very active inside Africa. Because I've got to be honest, it is an area that I don't pay enough attention to on a geopolitical basis, but there's been trouble brewing in Africa for a long time. It's always been a place that has had either resource problems, environmental problems, sociological problems, but also now you're seeing increasing amounts of political and geopolitical instability. And all, you take the map out, we've heard a lot about problems in Yemen and Somalia, so around what you might call the Horn of Africa, Djibouti, then of course Ethiopia, but then we've had issues in Sudan, Niger, Mali, Libya. If you take that map out above that northern part of Africa and just take from east to west, there are very few good stories. So what can you tell us about that at a high level before, because I'm not going to ask you to break down every country, because every country is worthy of its own discussion, but this is a theme, is it not, around geopolitical and political instability across Northern Africa?
Yes. Oh my God, where do I start with that question?
It's a hard question, right? And bear in mind, this is meant to be a 30-minute podcast, so unpack it as you will.
No, I love the segue that you made. First of all, by the way, love your military and defense analysis on Ukraine. I saw your piece in the Financial Review. Highly recommend it for those who haven't read it. And I really like where you're taking this in general. After Prigozhin's death, first of all, there were a lot of folks here in the United States. And, conspiracy theories run rampant. And there were folks said, including, by the way, the Wall Street Journal, that had an entire piece about how Prigozhin was so valuable to Putin that there was no way he could kill him because he depended on him. And a big part of that was due to Africa, because of what he had achieved in Africa, because of his export of Russian influence, especially at a time when you've got these global powers competing for influence. And he was the one who knew everything, right? So there was no way he could get rid of him. I always said he was a dead man walking. Most of us did. Most of us foreign policy experts thought that there was no way he'd last longer than a few weeks or months. And what you see now, when all this happened, The Wagner Group is going to get hit hard, but it's a weird time because, so they're now leaderless essentially, but that doesn't mean they don't not exist. On one hand, you've got the Wagner Group on the Russian side of things. Those that the Russian military has offered to consume, to take in some of those troops, those are related to Ukraine. Those in Africa seem to still be there. And a day before Prigozhin died, he released a video of himself in Africa. I don't think that means, by the way, that he was actually in Africa the day he released that video. So that's a very important point. But he did release this video. He had been in Africa, so it seemed, fighting for the thugs who hire him. And the issue that you have with all of these coups that are taking place. Now, you mentioned a series of them. Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger, and now Gabon that just happened, those are very recent. I saw a statistic on CNN that I thought was very fascinating, that there have been 9 coups in the past 3 years in former French colonies, including Mali.
Fascinating.
Isn't that fascinating? Mali, Guinea, Burkina Faso, Chad, Niger, Tunisia, and now Gabon. And each of them, as you said, each of them have totally different stories. Niger was a somewhat functioning democracy, had been at least for the last few years. So the coup there was completely different than what you had now. For example, in Gabon, the military junta took over again, military. However, it was against a family that had ruled Gabon for decades. And the leader who ruled with an iron fist and was ruthless had been in power for 14 years. They just had elections. Those elections have been viewed as completely illegitimate. So now the military junta has taken over. But again, the bottom line, no matter what the story is, military coups never end well. They always portend an extension of oppression. They often promise elections that almost never happens. And so each of the stories are different. But the fact is, when you've got this kind of instability and you've got militaries that are taking over that don't really have much regard or respect for democracy or human rights, and on top of it, you're facing a rapidly growing threat of Islamic insurgents. And that is particularly the case in West Africa. When you mix all of that, the risk with that is that even with this shakeup with the Wagner Group, with their head being killed, there is still going to be a demand on the part of these African dictators and thugs to hire these mercenaries to help them enforce this rule of law, to prevent any kind of dissent, and to tackle this threat posed by Islamic insurgents. And it's awful.
Right. I mean, so Wagner is a symptom of the problem, right? That they are supplying, they're not just turning up and creating instability like a hidden hand. They are being hired by, you know, very odious regimes to do a job. And also the thing about Wagner, one of the things that's probably less appreciated is that Wagner is only one element of Prigozhin's machine, the Concord group, as it were. That also included the misinformation, internet research factory that basically was involved in the 2016 meddling of the US presidential election, but also has mining interests. So they take as payment often gold mines and other resources within the African nations which they're operating, and then that allows them to obviously take a lot of money for themselves, but also provide kickbacks to the regime. So there's almost this, it's like a destabilization and authoritarian support in a box. Mm-hmm. So it comes with a lot of, so it's not just guys with guns. There are a whole lot of other things. Anyway, so keep going.
No, I know. I love that. You're right. You're right. I love how you characterize it. It's dictatorship in a box for sure. But as you said, they're very nimble and thugs for hire, but for whatever you want to achieve, for whatever nefarious behavior suits your fancy. One thing I find fascinating to take it back to Russia is just that days after Prigozhin was killed, General Surovikin was released. Do you remember him? He was the one who, first of all, by the way, looks exactly like Prigozhin. It's kind of freaky. They have a very similar bald
look. He
looks
a little bit like Dr. Evil, actually.
Yes. He looks like Dr. Yeah. Evil. That's right. Yeah. He just needs like a cat and he'll be all set. And
the General Armageddon from the Syrian war, right?
That so is
he was involved
right.
in the bombing of Aleppo, Aleppo.
That's right. That is his nickname, I guess. And he was detained right after the mutiny led by Prigozhin, and he's the one who was put out on video telling everybody to stand down. And it was seemed that he seemed to know about the mutiny hours before it took place. So he was detained. He was released days after his death. And I've been thinking about that because some of the media has been looking at that as, again, another sign of weakness. And I'm like, I don't think this is a sign of weakness. I think that the Russian government got what they wanted from him. They got all the details and information they needed. And now he's seen through his very eyes what could happen. And he is also likely a dead man walking. All this points to the cracks and fissures that are rising up to the Russian government. And and as you said, I think like you, it's a fierce battle between the anti and pro-war in Russia. And that can only portend Putin's end.
And so, bringing it back to Africa, that's a stunning statistic around 9 coups in over 3 years in former French colonies, so Francophone Africa. What does that tell you, if anything?
You know, well...
I mean, it doesn't seem like random.
I don't have good knowledge on how the French set up their systems in Africa under colonization, and so it's while it's tempting, it's a fascinating statistic because it's so tempting to say clearly there's something there the French did or didn't do when they left. The relationship now that you're seeing with a lot of with France and a lot of these countries is extremely strained. In Mali, for example, when they faced a major insurgency back before the coup, the French are the ones who stepped in to put a stop to it and to help the government retain control over Mali so that Islamic insurgents didn't threaten its survival. In Niger, now that those who overthrew the government remain in power, all the threats by ECOWAS, that's the Economic Community of West African States, in the days after the coup in Niger, ECOWAS threatened sanctions. They did impose, in fact, sanctions, and they closed the suddenly it's not coming to me. I've been on vacation too long. They closed the skies, as Zelensky would say. No fly zone. They put a no fly zone.
No fly zone.
Yeah. and then they threatened, though, military engagement. And we haven't seen that military engagement clearly. But Niger, the leaders are still there. And now, apparently, news reports say that Niger is talking with the French about the French withdrawing their troops. And we saw that a lot after the coup in Niger. A lot of this sentiment on behalf of the people of anti-West, anti-France,
right.
In particular.
And a lot of people have said that, you know, the Russians were involved because there was the images of people carrying Russian flags. A different analysis that I've read and heard from others, and it's one that I actually think is more probably relevant, is to your point, is that the Russian flag is not being pro-Russia per se, but it is almost a meme to be anti-West, anti-old colonial powers, anti-United States, anti-the Brits, anti-the French. And so it's more so that than some sort of expressing of outward support to Putin or Putin's Russia.
Yeah, well, Putin himself was not in favor of what happened in Niger. It was the Wagner group that was. So Putin came out to express concern about what happened, or the Russian government did at least. And it's Prigozhin who came out to say, you know, this is for freedom and we support you and we'll do whatever you need. And again, so they're not even on the same page about this. But as you said, ultimately it's about this anti-West theme, which, you know, I don't want to get ahead, but that was the theme of the BRICS summit.
Right. And, well, we'll come to this. Yeah, there's a little taster for everyone, but because like we could devote 10 hours to Africa, and is there one big thing that you are particularly worried about when you look at the instability we're seeing across so many different countries, and whether or not they all have their own localized causes, but are they bleeding into one another? Is this creating some sort of critical mass of instability? Because for a long time, we had Yemen, Somalia. Yemen was driven broadly by a drought, but then and both Somalia and Yemen, and then Djibouti, where the Chinese now have a base, that has allowed for a lot of bad actors, you know, Al-Qaeda, pirates and others to operate around that part of the world. Do you have those types of concerns if we see, you know, sort of massive instability across a huge region of the world?
Yeah, so we should note that Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger neighbor each other. So that is a huge chunk of land that has now faced military coups, and where they face this massive insurgent threat. It threatens Nigeria, which is very critical. Nigeria is south of Niger, and Nigeria faces an insurgent threat that the government is consistently trying to work against. They face a major problem of kidnapping for ransom, major problems of schoolgirls getting kidnapped. I'm sure you've heard all these stories in foreign workers getting kidnapped, particularly in the north of Nigeria. And so that threatens to destabilize Nigeria as well. Nigeria is an important one because it's a massive country with a massive population.
Huge population.
And a huge partner of a lot of countries around the world. This is not a country that we want to see get swallowed by this instability. So there are a few things in general that concern me. On one hand, when you've got this kind of instability and you have it spreading like this and spilling over into country after country, on one hand, it allows for sure terrorists, Islamic insurgents to take advantage of that vacuum and to spread their terrorism and their criminal behavior. And we've only seen that growing, by the way. These military coups, although some of them say that they are going to be the ones to crack down on the Islamic insurgents, has not proven to be successful at all in that. The second is you've got a message to particularly militaries across Africa in particular, that this is the best way to proceed with government change or change of power. And so it's almost like becoming a fad. There's this understanding that if you want change in Africa, elections might be rigged in certain countries. It might be a dictator. So this is the next best thing, but it never proves to be successful. And then the third is that these are resource-rich countries. So Gabon is rich in oil. Niger, for example, is rich in uranium and many other resources. So when you've got countries that are rich in resources like that, it's going to fall into the hands of either the military junta or the Islamic insurgents. And both ways, that's bad.
Or the Chinese Communist Party.
Can we add that? Sorry, let's add that last point, which is the last reason this matters is because Africa, in general, you've got this competition between the U.S. and China, and U.S. or Russia and China, but U.S. and China, in competing for influence across Africa. And to be honest with you, China is winning that game right now.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And this makes it harder.
Totally. Now, speaking of China.
Always.
We always speak
of China.
New topic for everyone. Oh, yeah, China? Tell me more. Let's talk about this map. So China's put out this new map of the world, and China has a very peculiar relationship with maps, history, international law. So they've put out this map.
Peculiar or delusional?
Well, I was being more polite than usual to my friends in the Chinese Communist Party. But let's talk about this map and then talk about why it matters, because it has set off an enormous diplomatic backlash right across the Indo-Pacific, ASEAN nations in particular. Talk about that.
Sure. So for those who don't know about this map, the Chinese, one of the ministries that handles maps, put out an official map that essentially lays claim and sovereignty to the entire South China Sea, which is also very rich in resources, speaking of, and also to the Himalayas, to a corner that is disputed between India and China, but like like really far into the Himalayas, parts that are really, really frankly part of India. So, so this, obviously this map has pissed off all of China's neighbors, India, Malaysia, Philippines, Vietnam, and it's because of this. Now, to be honest with you, when I first saw this,
and Indonesia, interestingly enough,
yes, and Indonesia, well, because they're near the South China Sea, and so and because all of it, and it's all going to have a trickle effect, right? Like if you're talking about resources from the sea, where there's fishing, where there's oil, where there's gas, you know, this is on top of it, by the way, where nobody recognizes these borders. Maritime borders are things, sometimes it can be difficult to figure out maritime borders, but some of it is actually very obvious, certain mileage off of the land. And China's even including that in its U-shaped line of the South China Sea. When I first saw this news, I scoffed a little bit because I was like, you know, the Chinese are delusional. The Chinese regime is delusional. What are they thinking? Nobody is going to respect this map anyway. What are they trying to do with it? But the problem and why these neighbors are so outraged, even though nobody is on China's side with this, is that it means that China will start enforcing how they view this map. And that's the real threat here. And it is really, I mean, they've already been exercising this threat, these laying claim to these territories and waters by sending their ships into territory that they shouldn't be, by they have troops in this disputed area between China and India, and it is currently Chinese controlled, not all of it, but most of it. And so the problem with that is that it just portends that they might be planning to enforce it in an even more strict fashion at a time when the world is focusing on Ukraine. I don't think folks are going to run to protect the sea as I don't. What do you think? Do you think that if they lay claim in a way between China and India or in the South China Sea? And by the way, as a military strategist would say, the smart thing would be to do all of it at the same time. But do you think that others are going to run to their defense? When I know in the United States, for example, we've said that we would do that regarding Taiwan. When I say run to their defense, I mean the U.S. will commit military resources to Taiwan. I'm not certain that the military itself would go there, but I don't know that who's going to defend them other than themselves. This is a real risk, and China knows that.
No, but it's the salami slicing approach that the Chinese favor to essentially change the reality on the ground. Mm-hmm. So they'll say, "Well, this is." They started constructing islands, and then they say, "Well, these are now part of China," and then they militarize them, and then suddenly there's a new reality. Much like now there's this new map. It's gone from a 9-dash line, which is like, honestly, I look at this, that 9-dash line, which is now a 10-dash line. It literally looks like some presumably guy in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs has just kind of got the map out and just got the magic marker and just drawn it.
Yeah.
It is like really that unsophisticated in its sort of...
I completely agree.
But yeah, like China's approach to things is to recast essentially facts that, okay, this is other countries' sovereign territory. They say, well, it's ours. And then they just sort of move in and use bullying on a one-to-one basis. So collectively, everyone agrees that this is not right. And you've mentioned the diplomatic backlash to it all. But then they deal with everyone on a bilateral basis. When they're in Filipino water, it's the Philippines that has to deal with them. And it's, you know, Chinese fishing fleets, inverted commas, which are essentially militarized fishing fleets, Coast Guard. And they come in with these gray zone fleets and they change the reality on the ground. And then because you can't kick them out if you're a smaller country militarily, what's the difference now? So you can complain about it, but now China's there, right? And so, and essentially that's how they're approaching it. I think where they bit off more than they can chew, and we'll talk about this now, is with their border skirmishes with the Indians, because that is a more fair-sized fight. Whilst China's military is stronger than India's, nevertheless, the countries are, you know, both massive, you know, geographically, population-wise, and increasingly geopolitically.
And they're both nuclear powers. I mean, these are not, a weak country. Exactly. They're
correct.
Provoking.
It's not a country they can just push around. And ironically, you know, those of us who've been hoping for the Indians to get off the sidelines and become more active with team democracy, it had the counterproductive effect for the Chinese on a geopolitical basis, because it activated the Indians into the Quad. It's made them much more suspicious of China and its ambitions, and so as a result, I think it hasn't helped. So, which sort of semi neatly takes me to this BRICS.
That's what I was thinking.
Meeting. Right. We had now, for those who don't know, BRICS being Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Rather peculiarly, sort of in that mix, but a grouping that was formed. Economically, principally, right? But now increasingly seeking to try to turn itself into some kind of counter block to whatever you want to call it, the West and its institutions, OECD, NATO plus the Indo-Pac 4, AUKUS, Quad, etc. But of course, India is a member of BRICS. So talk about what happened at BRICS, the expansion of the new members, what that means, and the dynamics there.
Sure. So this one was also fascinating. The BRICS, as you said, so it was created in 2009, largely for economic cooperation and also to cooperate on security and diplomatic measures and so on. It started with the four, as you mentioned. South Africa was added a year later. India and Brazil have generally been pro-West. And that's always been a little bit of a point of contention in their discussions. Now, the BRICS in general, its creation was meant to counteract the strength and prowess of the Western economies, U.S. economies, big economies around the world, and also to undermine the strength of the U.S., of the U.S. dollar. And they have never been able to succeed at that. And I have a lot of thoughts on that as a former U.S. Treasury person as to why those efforts, there are many reasons why I believe that these countries can try and try and try, and that it'll be extremely difficult to replace the dollar, but even to undermine the economic prowess of all these countries. And a lot of that, by the way, boils down to democracies and how our economic policies and businesses and so on. But anyway, so they had this
openness of trade, right? I mean, just to pick up on that, I mean, yes, China wants to be the reserve dollar, but reserve dollar status comes from an enormous amount of trust.
Yes, exactly.
And no one trusts the Chinese Communist Party's administration of the government. You know, it could put in capital controls at any time. Russia, clearly, right, zero trust. But we saw the capital controls that they put in place to prop up the ruble when they're having a currency crisis, you know, a little under a month ago. You just don't decide you're going to be a reserve currency. That is a status that's afforded on a huge trust and responsibility. Yes, it's an enormous advantage for the United States economy, but you don't get it for free, right? Like, there are essentially a heap of rules that come alongside that. If you decide you're just going to clamp down on capital, well, then your status as a reserve currency is dead. Anyway, continue.
Yes, I know. And that's why, by the way, so their expansion doesn't make a lot of sense given their stated goals, unless it's to try and create this anti-West, you know, team membership, a club membership, who of those, and even then it doesn't include that. So let me tell you the six countries they expanded by. So they've included now Argentina, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Ethiopia, Iran, and Egypt. And when you look at this list of six,
ragtag bag,
now it doesn't even make sense. You know, I tried as hard as I could to try and figure out the running theme.
I call it a coalition of whoever's prepared to turn up, right?
Yeah.
So you don't call it a coalition of the world. I mean, Argentina, the economic powerhouse,
right? Argentina's economy is flailing. So there's and their government has it's too many problems. So you've got that. Saudi Arabia, well, I mean, Saudi Arabia, we could list, enumerate.
The Saudi Arabians is an interesting one, because that to me is indicative of a bet each way from the Saudi regime, in the sense that, okay, yep, you know, they are always a longstanding ally with the United States, but they always do double deal, and this is they're doing their double dealing out in the open.
Yeah, they are. And listen, you know, the thing with the relationship between the US and Saudi Arabia, the US doesn't trust Saudi Arabia, but it is a strong relationship, and a very stronger than I would like, frankly. But the reason I could see Saudi Arabia taking this as a win for them. And, you know, it's a major group to join, another opportunity.
They're sitting at the table of a serious inverted commas. You know, yeah. There are,
yeah.
What, two members of the Security Council, nuclear powers. You could dress it up as looking like a big deal, right?
You could. But you mean to tell me that Saudi Arabia is going to sit at a table with Iran, even with the broker deal by China, and together, and by the way, the BRICS operate by consensus only. And so you mean to tell me that they're going to sit at a table and agree on these things? They have completely different foreign policy objectives and different objectives for their own status in that corner of the world. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. Ethiopia is reeling from a civil war that it is literally just gotten out of. Egypt is also massively struggling, hugely dependent on foreign aid. The UAE is strong, but the UAE has to be very careful with its alliances right now. And they're trying to, have their cake and eat it too, when they, you know, being, by being friends with everybody. It is a ragtag team. Like you said, number one, they're not going to achieve their goal, their stated goal at least.
Oh, so there's not going to be a BRICS currency coming at any time that I can't change of. The Argentine peso for
Bitcoin. I just came out. You know what? I should trademark that before they take it. But Bitcoin, I don't think will happen. I don't think they're going to undermine the strength of the dollar or any other currency around the world, by the way. And I certainly don't think they're going to undermine the economic powers that are the other global economic powers. I think that they'll probably come up with some nice trade agreements for themselves. Good for them. That's always a good thing. But beyond that, this was nothing more I saw than an attempt by China to grow this group and to try and make it as an anti-West thing. And you could look at the statement that their Minister of Commerce delivered in the place of President Xi at this summit, which was, you know, it didn't name the United States specifically, but it kept talking about the hegemon and hegemonic behavior. And they, you know, they're looking at the United States when they say that.
So let's talk about that. Xi Jinping, you know, he's tried to be on a charm offensive since COVID, you know, and particularly they're very feeling, I think, exposed by their closeness of relationship, the friendship of no limits with Russia. After Putin invaded Ukraine, it all went tits up in Australian parlance. So
I don't think that expression would work here, but I like it.
Anyway, so what do we make of Xi not attending BRICS, not going to the G20? It seems counterproductive to what China's... It almost is like a toys out of the cot type situation from the Chinese leadership. What do you make of that? I'm just trying to think through... Because, you know, the Chinese try to push in where they think the American leadership or the Western leadership is either vacated, like perhaps in Africa, or been hypocritical. Like, you remember, there was this big hullabaloo when, and we're going back now, but Trump becomes president, talks about trade, American carnage, and the fact that they're going to start looking at essentially winding back US support for global trade, and what had been called the Washington Consensus, whatever, around trade liberalization, globalization, etc. Xi Jinping turns up, I think was it the IMF or World Economic Forum or somewhere, and gives this big speech saying, oh, we're going to be the great proponents of free trade, and everyone, because that's what everyone wanted to hear. And of course, that was complete bullshit. But what do you make of them not attending conferences? Because that really is almost a degree of frustration that they're not winning this alliance game. I see that as a victory for the Biden administration and its focus on alliances and multilateral institutions and the way that China has been outboxed in all these forums. But what's your take on it?
Well, on President Xi and his missing the speech at BRICS, at the BRICS summit specifically, I don't see too much into that. It was major news because it's not something that is normal for the Chinese president ever. Every step is curated, and they don't like to leave room for conspiracies. And the fact is that he was in attendance at the BRICS summit in South Africa, missed the speech, and it can only be one of three things. Either he fell ill, or he had some pressing matter he had to tend to, or there was something that happened at the summit that pissed him off and he wanted to make a show. But the fact is that he showed up for the dinner that night. And so that's why, for me personally, even though it's so uncharacteristic of him, and it was very clear the Chinese media was trying to cover it up by not reporting the speech at all, by the way, to me it feels like a pressing matter that came up that he had to attend, that something that's not that there isn't as much there. But it's
got to be a big deal to give up a speech. I mean, but anyway, keep going.
You have a point. Perhaps he was trying to show.
It's compelling when you think about, we just spend all this time talking about, you know, whilst it's, we believe, you know, a vainglorious attempt at creating a sort of counter Western bloc, they see this as some kind of central piece of architecture. I mean,
if it were other events and he pulled a stunt, the Turkish government does this, Erdogan does this a lot, Putin does this a lot apparently, and you kept people waiting for an hour, let's say, or you go and you don't show up for the speech, and you know, you're the highly coveted person. Everybody's waiting. One could argue that it's a ploy, a strategy to make everybody remember who's the boss and who calls the shots. But because he attended the dinner later, that's why I just didn't see it like that. I was like, I don't know what you're trying to convey here, but you didn't succeed, Xi. Message not received.
And so, okay, so then talk about Indonesia not attending, the fact she's not going to rock up to, you know, he's sending the foreign minister in his place to other meetings. I mean, what do you make of that?
Well, I think that there's a deliberate effort there to make it known who's the boss, what would be that it would take a lot to get the president there. And you know, these games, this is so typical. When I was in the US government, these types of games were very common of who attends, at what level, you know, what level are you going to send somebody to a certain event when, you know, the president is invited perhaps to speak at something, but you're going to send the national security advisor, or you're going to send the secretary of state, you know, these, and those are very calculated moves. You have a point about him missing this, you know, missing a speech is a big move, is a big deal. And so perhaps to do it, but on other, for other events, at least for other summits that have happened, you know, I know the Ukraine peace talks have been a big one where they've been trying to get the Chinese. They did not succeed at doing that in Amsterdam. They did succeed at doing that in Saudi Arabia. At all those other events, I think a lot of it has to do with, we want to make sure everyone knows who's the boss, number one, and that it would have to be a major, major event to get us there. And that's, by the way, how they've been treating the US now post, after the Chinese spy balloon incident. You see the US officials flocking to China. The US Secretary of Commerce was just there last week. In fact, while she was there, she said that, I did not like this quote. She said that getting rid of TikTok would mean losing every American voter under the age of 35. Number one, that's a dumb negotiating tactic to go say that in China. And number two,
well, who are they going to vote for? The Chinese Communist Party? Are they running a candidate?
I don't know. And number two, I don't think that's accurate. I think that's a really bad, yeah. I don't think that's true.
This is a quick side note.
But the Chinese, they want that. They want people running to them.
I mean, this is just a complete dogleg, so don't feel the need to really dig into this. But when the Biden administration was talking about a ban of TikTok, and it was sort of back on the table maybe a year ago, obviously the Trump administration tried, but in their particular style was a bit ham-fisted about it. But nevertheless, the problems around TikTok are well known. They're off government devices, et cetera. Certainly in Australia they are now as well. But the ACLU at the time, the American is it Civil Liberties
Union? Mm-hmm. You have it right.
They were campaigning. Now they're an ideological group that are around people's civil liberties, but they were campaigning very aggressively amongst young people, saying this is like a totalitarian move by the government to silence your voice. They're taking away TikTok from young people, blah, blah. Because obviously the popularity of TikTok amongst young people is, particularly young people, but generally is part of the challenge. And I thought to myself, man, to unpack the sort of, you know, you're sort of trying to say, okay, you're coming out in support of an app or a platform that is created by and essentially in service to or in servitude to or can be subjugated by the Chinese Communist Party, the largest, most authoritarian, the real big brother regime around the world. And if the United States, a liberal democracy, decides that we're not comfortable with all the things that come alongside that, that they are breaching civil liberty. Yeah, you understand the sort of the logic loop there, and you kind of go, I think you guys might be looking at the world upside down here. But anyway, I just make that point.
So, Misha, I agree with you. And when this came out, so for listeners, the Montana, a state here, has completely banned TikTok, not just on government devices. It is banned in the state of Montana. Now, I don't know.
Very Yellowstone. It feels very Yellowstone to me.
I guess. Right? I don't know how. I'm not a tech person. I don't know logistically how you do that for a certain state. But they banned it, and it has immediately released these legal threats that of the ACLU and others saying that it violates free speech in the United States. And so I was part of another podcast discussion about this, actually, with a lawyer, where I had a great issue with that. I was like, I just don't see that. There are other social media platforms. So how on earth could taking one of them away violate someone's access to free speech? They could equally just go to another platform and say whatever it is they want to say or do whatever dance they want to do. And by the way, I'm a huge fan of these social media platforms in general. I mean, there are a lot of problems with them, but I'm a huge fan based on my own media brand. And so this lawyer explained to me this very long explanation where at the end, the bottom line of what he said, and it was a little bit, it was quite compelling, was that there is an argument that because there are all these users who are only on TikTok, and that by taking TikTok away from them, if they choose to voice themselves on that platform, then they should be able to voice themselves on it and not be forced to move to something else. Anyway, listen, I'm not a legal expert, but that is the argument.
No, the thing for me is more that just it is rewarding the Chinese Communist Party with a reciprocity that they do not afford the rest of the world, right? Mm-hmm. So we're saying, yep, you can operate problematic platforms inside democracies that have huge problems, spread misinformation, etc. But by the way, you can't Google Tiananmen Square inside of China and get anything other than Tiananmen Square is a lovely place to visit. Certainly nothing happened here in 1989 and the like, right? Yeah, you can't use Facebook, Twitter, but et cetera, right? And so I just think sometimes I look at this, I get the intention and it's well-intended, but you need to take a broader view. Anyway, I don't want to, this was not the purpose of the conversation. just returning back to Xi, I want to change topics quickly, but Xi not going to the G20, I think as we've spoken a lot here about the map, the new map and what that means and their sort of attempts around BRICS, what it tells me by not rocking up to the G20 is that they're not really caring anymore about soft power particularly. I think that they are increasingly going to be like, take it or leave it. And that, I think, is dangerous. And I put it in this context. And not that we should care. I mean, ultimately, it tells me, I do think it does highlight the great success the Biden administration has had in repositioning the United States at the center of the alliance system and of multilateral institutions. I think it's actually been very successful in that. You could look at that as a marker of that success, that the frustration of China feeling they're on the outer in all these groups. Not because that somehow the China, they would say, oh, well, the Americans are, cajoling everyone, et cetera. It comes down to just essentially they just don't have a very attractive propositional worldview, right? You can't bully everyone and say, by the way, be on my team. you're either a bully or you're not. And so there is, when you overlay that, and you know, we talked a little bit about Xi Jinping's domestic focuses, the Chinese pressure on its economy, I think, is something that we need to watch very closely. You know, a lot of people talk about, are we going through peak China, huge debt problems happening inside of China, and they can't seem to get off this rat wheel of economic growth being driven by essentially construction, manufacturing, exports, and debt.
Can I interrupt you on that for a second? Because that's super important point that I meant to mention earlier with the BRICS, there with this whole China effort of creating an anti-West bloc that could undermine other economies and the strength of the dollar. They have two banks that they've created. One of them is, well, one of them was founded by the BRICS. One of them is by China. It's the New Development Bank. And it has now, this bank has, cannot make any loans, has cannot raise dollar funds to repay its debts. So this bank that was created to counter the dollar now needs dollars to repay its debts. And a lot of that is because of the reasons you just said. Its cousin, it has another, there's another China-based multilateral lender called the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, which was also created to kind of make this counterweight. And now it's in the middle of a PR crisis because it's being accused of being controlled by members of China's Communist Party. And the last thing I would note is that China's largest real estate, I hope I say this right, property company, Evergrande.
Yeah, conglomerate.
Yes, conglomerate is a better word. Evergrande has filed for bankruptcy in the United States.
Right.
And this, and that is because of all the issues you just said, and that threatens to have ripple effects all over the world. So,
well, China's looking at its own GFC, right? I mean, this is essentially similar problems, almost writ large, to where the United States property market got itself to, essentially bad debts, overconstruction, etc. But the difference, of course, is that the Chinese Communist Party's regime's legitimacy is predicated on economic growth, right? And so if they're not able to deliver economic growth and jobs growth, etc., and look, youth unemployment, again, going to a dog leg, so I'm going to conclude it here, but China has enormous youth unemployment. They've got a real problem with the disaffected young people. Never a good sign if you're a dictatorship. But their solution to the youth unemployment crisis, Hagar, is to stop publishing the statistics. So problem solved, right?
Of course. Why didn't I think of that?
Right. Anyway, yeah, exactly, right? Now, we talked a lot about Putin. We've talked a lot about unusual alliances. Let's talk about Kim Jong-un, so-called rocket man, who's gone to visit Putin in Moscow. What do we make of this?
Wow. Listen, I'm going to make a lot of fun on this about this later because I feel like Kim Jong-un is getting the attention he finally wanted. But it's not good news because Russia needs weapons and they could get it from North Korea. So that's an opportunity for North Korea to sell Putin weapons he wants. And then on the North Korean side, they need money and food. And that's what they're asking for, apparently. And so these are, you know, we in the United States don't want to undermine food from getting to North Korea. But when you're talking about a deal from between two thugs about for an arms deal, and that's, by the way, this intelligence that has been broken out here, that
guns for butter, essentially.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. And this is not good news because you've got these. Now, I don't think it can be very long lasting is the thing. There's only so much North Koreans can sell. There's only so much Putin can buy. But it's at a time when things are so critical in Ukraine, when they are advancing to this extent, and when Russia is increasingly looking more and more desperate and trying to pull out every card that it can. This is not something you want to see happen. So it's not good. The U.S. has come out, which, by the way, publicly to say that they hope North Korea doesn't engage in this deal because of, I don't know, some promises that they claimed some promises to not getting involved in the Ukraine war. And I'm like, are you really calling on Kim Jong-un to behave?
Yeah, to honor his deal.
But
it is, I mean, yeah, I agree. On a tactical basis, it's concerning. But what it does show you is this is where Putin's been reduced to, is begging.
Yeah, club of thugs.
Kim Jong-un for weapons. I mean,
you're right.
Like, this is a country that aspires to global power, great power status. And that to me Again, when I always look at these indicators of where Russia's heading under Putin, I just don't see any good green lights ahead. It's all just red or orange, and eventually I think it's just all going to fall over. But yeah, you're right, in the near term it is problematic. Now, we've gone over time as always, so we can't let you go without getting your what's the story, John Dory. What do you got for us in the wonderful world of weird foreign news?
So I'll try to keep this one brief, and it's an area that we don't talk a lot about, Brazil, but it's touched the United States in a really funny, odd way. So apparently an investigation that has led to watches being sold, Rolex watches and other stuff, high-end, very high-end watches and jewelry being sold out of a Pennsylvania mall, Pennsylvania state, you know, just south of New York, and being sold out of a mall have led to or are traced back to Jair Bolsonaro, the former president of Brazil, who's facing, by the way, a wide range of investigations and all sorts of criminal investigations. One of them is related to corruption. And apparently it appears that he received all these gifts from the Saudis, specifically jewelry, watches, and so on. And it appears that his band of thugs are selling it in the United States and that he's receiving the cash profit from it, which, by the way, is usually called a form of money laundering. And so
right. There's a technical term.
Yes, yeah. Because it's not allowed in Brazil, as it is not here either, to receive these gifts and claim them for yourself. The United States rule on foreign gifts is extremely strict. It's $20. And if it goes over, which means you can't even accept lunch from somebody, you have to split the lunch. You can accept coffee. That is literally about it. Coffee and a snack. So
I was going to say, coffee prices in Washington are pretty high these days.
You might and that's it about it. Yeah, that's about it. and so, you know, it was very awkward when I was in the U.S. government, the gifts that we would have to turn down, or you accept them basically, but then you pass them over to another office. They become properties of the state. They're not your property. And that is a very clear and easy distinction. Apparently in Brazil, it is the exact same thing. I don't know the monetary limit, but I do know that it's the same law. And so, you know, just the idea, one of his thugs apparently was caught at the airport in Brazil with something like $3 million worth of jewels and watches from Saudi Arabia. And they believe he was intending to sell it on behalf of Jair Bolsonaro. So just fascinating, you know, just yet another absurd layer of these leaders and the webs they weave and the way they try to make some money here in the United States.
Yeah, he was called, I mean, you know, a lot of people, well, he's very close to Donald Trump, Bolsonaro, but everyone called him.
Well, Trump was accused of the same, by the way, same behavior.
Right. It's the same grifting. It's a grifting mindset that is really kind of instructive there. Now, the John Dory I have is, believe it or not, last week there was an enormous search for the Loch Ness Monster.
For those of you who can't see, I am shaking my head.
Well, this has happened. And so to finally unravel the mysteries, they got all the best sensors and all the best microphones and all the enthusiasts came along and commenced a big search. And drum roll, found inconclusive information.
You know, you had me on the edge of my seat because I was on vacation and did not see this news. And I was hoping you would come with something exciting.
Well, but they did hear some unusual sounds. Unfortunately, and this is just such a disaster, they didn't record them because there was some problem with the recording devices. So that's a great
pretty
game.
Amateur.
Right. And also... But also, it was live streamed, this thing. So one of the enthusiasts claims they saw a shadow under the water on the live stream. So the mystery, listeners, continues. So, you know.
I expect you to get to the bottom of this mission.
Someone actually, and there was some new photos released. Not new, they were from 2018, but the person who had them took it upon themselves to release these photos just recently as part of this new investigation. The photos... appear to show something very unclear also. So there you go. The mystery continues. Hagar, we still have not got to the bottom of the Loch Ness Monster that we've tried over many, many years. It goes back, I think, to the 6th century, I think, is the original
sighting. Is it? It's a long time.
I think so. It goes back a long way. Anyway, so look, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's a great place to end things. Perhaps you want to just tell us about some of the changes you've got to your show there?
Yes, it's an exciting week. Thank you so much for asking me. So my show is Oh My World. It's world news and political satire on YouTube and across social media platforms. And this week we are launching a line of educational videos that are meant to teach students and others who are interested in foreign policy all the basics of international affairs and geopolitics. So they're short, they're 2 to 3 minutes, they're fun and easy, and they're mostly animated. And they answer questions like, what's realism? What's liberalism? What's the UN? What's the difference between the World Bank and the IMF? What's a security dilemma? Things like that. These theories are often taught in a very complex, completely incomprehensible way, and which I find, you know, it dissuades people from studying it. It excludes people. And so I hope that these videos teach it in a fun way, but also inspire others to pursue these fields.
Well, it sounds like something I should be watching to brush up on.
I should have you help me host.
If you see my unique identifier as having watched these videos, I'm just brushing up. Right? I'm showing others. Thanks for coming on. And look, I can reveal that our episodes together have been outperforming the traditional long form deep dives with people. So,
really?
Which is not surprising, but also tells me, look, you're still going to have to eat your vegetables, people, and listen to my long, boring conversations with other people. But it is always great to have you on, Hagar. We do cover a lot of territory. And so until next time, see you soon.
That made my day. See you, Misha.
G'day, Diplomates fans. Well, I hope you enjoyed that episode. Hagar is amazing. Check out the show notes if you want to see more from Hagar and follow her amazing show, Oh My World. Also, check out the show notes where I've got links to my AFR columns, but also to my book, The Sun Will Rise, which is available from Simon & Schuster and every other place you can buy a book. It comes out in late November, but you can start buying it now. Now, I've got a question from Jamie. Jamie says, Misha, should we be worried about Vladimir Putin potentially escalating things if Ukraine continues to attack Russia inside of Russia? So that's a good question. So a bit of context. Increasingly, we've seen a lot of attacks behind enemy lines, as it were. Russia is being attacked on not in civilian targets, on military targets, air bases and the like. Essentially, towns that are not just on the border, but parts of Russia that are quite a long way away from the frontline fighting. I think the short answer to this is no. If we were going to see escalation from Putin, he would have already done it. Frankly, what Putin can do is extremely limited because of how far his military has been stretched on the ground. I think what it does do is it imposes costs on the Russian people and the Russian nation of this war. So for a long time, they've been essentially insulated from it. I often think of Winston Churchill, who during the Blitz in 1940, Britain was in deep trouble. France was occupied. United States has not yet entered the war. The Germans have not yet invaded Russia. So it looks very, very dire for Britain at this point. And then Churchill insists that the RAF, the Royal Air Force, bomb Berlin. Now, why? Wasn't going to turn the war. In fact, far from it, a long way from where Normandy and the parts of Europe that would need to be liberated before getting to Germany and to Berlin, which didn't happen, of course, in 1945. But the reason he did that is he wanted to impose costs on the German people. And I kind of liken that to this situation. Putin's whole reputation on the line with Russian people is that, well, I keep Russia strong, safe, and secure. If Russia is being attacked inside of Russia, if there are drone strikes on the Kremlin, if there are if there are military targets being blown up, if towns like Belgorod are being raided by Russian separatists crossing the border from Ukraine, that is bad for Putin. It ratchets up the pressure. And what's interesting is that Putin is trying to ignore this problem. He's not talking about it. Take Belgorod, essentially to protect Belgorod, the Russians would need to move troops there. And of course, that would take them away from the south and the southeast where they wanted to be defending those lines against the Ukrainian military. So he's in a very invidious position, but I think it is politically unsustainable for Russia to continue to be attacked inside Russia. It just builds that pressure on the regime. And I think eventually something will go pop there. Anyone wants to talk about how, or sorry, wants to know about how regime change happens, I wrote a column about this right after Prigozhin's aborted coup, which I'm sure from his grave or his room in hell, he's thinking, I wish I went through with it. Anyway, you need pressure, you need triggers. The pressure is building, and I think those attacks are part of the journey. Anyway, thank you so much for the question. Please rate and review the show. Until next time, bye for now.
You were just listening to Diplomates, a geopolitical chinwag. For more episodes, visit www.diplomates.show or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or through any of your favorite podcast channels.
This podcast was brought to you by Minimal Productions, producer Jim Mintz.